The first season of Walking Dead culminates in the destruction of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, and I can't think of a better anti-federal fantasy than that.
I'm Catherine Mangy Ward for Reason TV, and I'm here today with Paul Cantor, who's a professor of English at UVA and the author of a new book, The Invisible Hand in Popular Culture. Thanks for talking with us, Paul.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So popular culture comes in for some pretty negative vibes from cultural critics as a general matter. We're talking about the Kardashians and, you know, reality TV and Honey Boo Boo. You are sticking up for at least some aspects of popular culture. Talk about why that is.
Well, nobody ever condemns books in general and says all books are bad. There are a lot of bad, stupid books being written. Well, television is the same way. The majority of stuff on television is worthless, to be honest. But like any other medium, it's grown up. And now I'd say probably the best writing being done in the world today is for television shows.
You say American popular culture not only celebrates freedom, it is also itself an example of American freedom at its best and most vibrant. Where particularly do you see that?
People who defend capitalism and free markets better not attack popular culture, because right now one of the left's remaining arguments against capitalism is that look at how bad popular culture is. My point is that in fact we can be very proud of the record of movies and television coming out of the United States. Again, the majority are bad, but the peaks are great. I would take the 25 best movies produced in America in the 20th century and match them against the 25 best anything except Shakespeare's 25 best plays. And what I mean is that free markets do succeed in culture just the way they do everywhere else. It's a process of trial and error and feedback. We got hundreds of people out there free to produce what they want. The public can then choose what they like, and critics like me can choose what they think is artistically successful.
You talk about how South Park exemplifies a lot of your themes, and you see traces of influences of some great political philosophers amongst the underpants gnomes in your chapter, Cartman Shrugs. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, South Park is a perfect example of what I have in mind. It's a really interesting, provocative, thoughtful show. It's a very libertarian show. It defends capitalism, defends entrepreneurship. It grows out of a long tradition of philosophical humor. The main charge against South Park is that it's dirty. The language is filthy. But I point out in the chapter that you can find that in Rabelais, you can find it in Shakespeare, you can find it in Chaucer, you can find it in Mark Twain.
Where are the kind of literary antecedents, or kind of what are the roots of the wrap-up lesson at the end of South Park? I think that's sort of an artificial device that many people know about the show. Is it something about sort of authority has to be rational, or you have to kind of derive the lesson yourself as a viewer, or is it just a cheesy TV trope that works?
I think it's more of the latter, but it's a long tradition of works of literature, of drawing some kind of moral at the end, and they're having fun with that, and really point out to people that these shows are not the mindless entertainment many people claim they are, and some of those endings are in fact very thoughtful, very balanced, judicious resolutions of issues. I show that, for example, in the episode about gay scout leaders, that on the one hand, the show makes fun of people who don't like homosexuals and don't want them in the Boy Scouts. On the other hand, the would-be homosexual Boy Scouts leader himself defends freedom of association.
I'm proud to be gay, and I'm proud to be in a country where I'm free to express myself. But freedom is a two-way street. If I'm free to express myself, then the Scouts have to be free to express themselves too.
He himself feels the Scouts should be able to exclude him, not because he would do it himself, but because that's their right as an organization. That's a very balanced account of a very hot issue.
And they do it in an episode that also features a character named Big Gay Al.
Yes, that's right. Who we're talking about here. Big Gay Al is out and proud.
Excellent. So academic cultural criticism kind of veers between two extremes, right? You have your kind of Frankfurt School-inspired popular culture is just here to anesthetize the masses and make them amenable to consumption. And then you have, I think, this sort of, maybe it's a newer critique that we're living in this very fragmented media landscape, and that the internet and niche publishing make it so that No one even has kind of a basis of common conversation anymore. I suspect you would say that both of those schools are wrong, but can you kind of talk about why?
Well, the Frankfurt School was a product of German emigres coming to Hollywood in the 1940s. And for example, they didn't find Donald Duck funny.
Heil Hitler! What's that you say, Schweinhund?
If I didn't speak English, I might not find Donald Duck funny. One of my theses about the Frankfurt School is as the product of emigres who really didn't understand American culture. They viewed it the way an anthropologist would view the strange customs of a foreign land. I think it's very sad that a whole strain of pop culture criticism has grown out of that. As for the other view, they're missing the main point that, in fact, right now, television is forming our common culture for good or ill. That is what I see among my students, among my academic friends. We come to a conference about Shakespeare. At dinner, we sit around discussing Breaking Bad, Mad Men, and The Walking Dead.
So your day job is teaching Shakespeare and Homer to college students. On the side, you publish about Gilligan's Island and South Park, but you have said in the past that you would never do zombies, and now your position on that is weakening. What happened?
Yes, I finally felt too much pressure that I ought to see if my thesis would apply to zombies. So I've just written an essay on The Walking Dead, and it led me to reflect on the widespread apocalyptic scenarios in American popular culture now, zombie plagues, alien invasions. And I realized that the primary fantasy in American television right at the moment is to get rid of the federal government.
After the blackout, nothing worked. Governments fell. Militias rose up.
Oh, the world we know is gone. But keeping our humanity? That's a choice.
We love situations where aliens invade and destroy the federal government, zombies show up and destroy the federal government, and people want to see what life would be like. And of course, it's tough, it's dangerous, but actually in all these shows, a lot of good things result. Families get back together, people start homeschooling their children, they have home health care, they become self-reliant. The first season of Walking Dead culminates in the destruction of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, and I can't think of a better anti-federal fantasy than that.
On that optimistic note, thank you so much for talking with us, Paul. I'm speaking today with Paul Cantor, author of The Invisible Hand in Popular Culture. I'm Catherine Mengue Ward for Reason TV.
Ha 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 ha